the Podfix Network.
Hello and welcome to episode 230 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk filmmaking, from indie film to studio films and everything in between. How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try to F it up, in our very, very humble opinion. I am Giles Alderson, a writer, director and a producer, and I am delighted to welcome on this week's show the fantastic Joe Marcantonio. Now, Joe sits down with me and talks all about his career leading up to his latest film, Kindred, which is out now on Sky. It stars Fiona Shaw, Jack Loudon, and Tamara Lawrence. It's co-written by Jason McColgan with Joe, and it is a delight. If you've not seen it yet, go watch it. It's available now on Sky. If you have Sky, you have no excuses. Go support this brilliant, brilliant film. It is Joe Marcantonio's debut feature film as a screenwriter and as a director, and it's a beauty. We talk about his latest short, which led him on to Kindred, called Red Light, which stars the fantastic Jesse Buckley. We kind of shot it as a proof of concept. We talk about that a little bit. We talk about working with script and with actors, how he likes improvising, how he likes to workshop the script with the actors so it feels real with them, and how he gets his ideas and how he writes his screenplays. We also talk about dealing with reviews, the differences between the UK and the US, how they differ, how a therapist on set might help, and why being a director is not being a dictator. We also talk about what he learnt being a runner on set and how he started out making music videos and commercials, and how any job in this industry can lead to other jobs, and how cast in a low-budget indie film can mean everything. We dive into all that on this week's episode of the Filmmakers Podcast. It is a long one. This might be a two-parter, so I'm going to let you dive straight in now. Shout-outs to our Patreon listeners. If you haven't yet signed up, do. There is so much bonus material for you on there. So dive in. Come join us. I'll give bigger shout outs on Friday. If I'm doing a two-parter, hint, probably am. So anyway, I'll talk more about Wolves of War then and what else I've learnt. So I've got some other inciting tidbits for you. But for now, sit back, relax and enjoy my chat with Joe Marcantonio.
Hello.
Hey, Joe, how you doing, buddy?
How you doing, man? You're right.
I'm good. I can't see you at the moment, by the way.
Can you not? Oh, wait, 1 minute. I'm coming.
There he is. Now I can see your mic and your setup.
Check out my ridiculous mic system. This one's a little bit roomy,
right?
And this one's a bit deep and meaningful.
Yeah, so, it means
so you know,
you can do both.
I can do both.
I'm in my missus's little mini office. It's a shed in the garden, basically.
Okay, yeah.
Because it's the coolest place in the house right now.
Yeah, it is a hot day.
It's so hot. My dog is now lying at my feet. She'll get up and start barking at a pigeon in a minute. But I've got the fan on, and I'm worried about this fan, Joe, because this fan, it's quite noisy. But I'm hoping in the edit that Toby, our new editor, can just get rid of it, because otherwise I'll have to turn it
off.
If it's a constant noise,
you'd be right.
Should be all right, shouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm in the attic of the house,
done.
Which is equally like a little bit like an oven. But it's fine, I've got a big window next to me, and as long as one of the neighbours doesn't start playing loud music or, you know, having a fight or something, it should be fine.
Yeah, you'll be all right.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
What part of the country are you in?
I am in Mill Hill. I'm in North London.
Okay.
Where are you?
Yeah. I'm in West London. I'm in Acton. So,
nice.
Sunny, glamorous Acton.
I used to live in Ealing, well, Northfield.
Okay, yeah.
And I kind of lived in Acton for a little while. Yeah, it's all right there. Yeah. It's pleasant.
So, it's not too bad. You know, I'm a kind of vaguely London born and bred. So, when we had a kid, we were living in like Islington, and we had a kid, and we're like, oh, we need to get closer to family. So, this is like as close to Richmond as I could afford to live, basically. Couldn't get any closer.
The close to Richmond as you could afford. Is that your dream? Is it got to get as close to Richmond as you possibly can?
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. That's where the babysitters are, in theory. So,
right. And that's important with filmmaking, to have, like, teams around you. You've got to have those, again, like teams we talk about, filmmaking teams, but you need your family team as well.
Oh,
right?
Honestly, like, my mother-in-law is actually lives fairly close to us here, and she was a real lifesaver making the movie. Just
because. Oh, really?
We shot in Ireland, and, you know, when you got two fairly young kids, someone's got to be kind of helping out doing bedtime, because my wife couldn't do it all on her own. She works as well, yeah, part-time, so.
Of course.
We make it work as best we can, you know how it is.
And that's the thing, I think that's the thing people don't talk about a lot, is that help you need. I know filmmakers who don't have family around, and I'm like, how do you do it, you know, with the family?
Yeah.
I'm like, how do you, you know, look after the kids? And they'll always just take them to set. I'm like, yeah, but really? No, we take them to set. I'm like, wow, it's hard enough taking the dog to set, let alone
that sounds
child.
sounds like hell.
I know, my
kids are not well behaved. That sounds like a really, really bad idea, taking them to set. My wife came out to visit for like one day. She came out on like a Thursday night, stayed for the Friday, and we flew back for the weekend together. And that was enough. Just one day with someone on set. Was just like, you know, you got other things to concentrate on, you know.
Of course you have.
Rather than making sure they've had
this.
Their lunch or whatever. You know?
Yeah, totally.
It was quite funny because I'm so used to doing kind of smaller jobs and little commercials and whatever that, like, I remember that, like, the night before she came, I was like sitting, I was having a coffee or probably having lunch and chatting to the second AD and being like, oh, my wife's got to work out what to do after shooting tonight because I've got to go get my wife. And she looks at me and just like, what do you mean? I was like, well, yeah. We're in the middle of nowhere in Ireland. I've got to go and pick her up from the airport. She's like, you don't have to do that. I'm like, well, someone's got to pick her up. She's like, yeah, like, that's my job. I can organise that for you. I'm like, oh, right, okay. I'm
oh, yeah,
really
there's people
this.
Here. Like, yeah,
people
exactly.
People actually doing
that.
Stuff.
Yeah, doing stuff for me. Hang on, you can go pick them up. Yeah. And it's weird because your missus probably went, oh, someone coming to collect me that isn't you. How
she
exotic.
Did, yeah, and like... Yeah, it had the driver came and get her from
the
set,
driver.
Who like usually ferries Fiona Shaw around, so you know, like a bit of kind of like a
little
celebrity
mini
rub-off.
Celebrity, but, that which is nice. I know it's behind you on the wall there. You have a load of white cards up on a cork board. I'd love for you to tell me that it was a chess game, but more importantly, I think it'd be good to say, no, it's my latest film, or it's my... Is that your script ideas and everything down in note form?
Yeah, so basically, my writing system is, I don't really have one cemented system, but I tend to, like, try and get scenes up on kind of card and then put them on the board and try and kind of, like, do a kind of, a bit of a kind of, you know, you work out where things work and where things don't. You know, it's nice to see it visually. Whereas in, like, you know, if you're doing it in Word or in notes or something, cutting and pasting constantly, you know, you kind of lose track of things a little bit. It's nice to have, like, it physically in front of you. So what I do is when I'm starting a new idea, you know, I will tend to work on character and plot and then get it on the board when I've got some specific scenes in mind. I'm like, oh, okay, so for this is like something, what one is that? Sorry, I need to just refer to the notes.
Please do.
So that's the thing I've been writing with a co-writer of mine, Owen.
A colleague, I like that. A colleague of mine.
We're kind of colleagues. We've been kind of working. It's a bit of a long story. We're a bit of a trio. So it's me.
Jason?
There's me and there's Jason. There's another guy called Owen. And the three of us went to film school together like 22 years ago.
Oh,
and we all live in London. Owen's from Wales and Jason is from Northern Ireland and I'm from London. Uh-huh. And we all have slightly different jobs in kind of quote-unquote the industry. So like Owen and I kind of do the same thing. We're like freelance directors in like commercials and kind of content and kind of whatever we can get. Mm-hmm. And Jason is more of a kind of producer in that world. Mm-hmm. He works for an ad agency. But the three of us write together. So I've written this film Kindred with Jason, and then I've written a film called Uncle with Owen, and then I've written this film with Owen on the board, which I can't really say the name of because I'm worried someone's going to steal the title.
Don't.
But it's like a kind of it's kind of like a murder mystery,
nice
kind of thing, set in America. So that's like one of my kind of first big kind of hopefully to shoot in America set things. So.
Yeah.
I guess we can come on to that a bit later.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Then I've just finished another thing with Jason, or not finished, finished first draft of something with Jason, which is an Irish set kind of thriller. And then Jason and Owen, without me, have written a couple of things together. So, like, the three of us are kind of like a weird triangle of, like, kind of getting things done.
That's amazing. It's Jason McColgan.
McColgan
is pronounced. Owen Dawkins. McColgan. Yeah. Jason has listened to the podcast quite regularly, and he sends me messages in the past when I was looking up and your work. I was like, Jason, I know that name. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's written to me in the past. What a lovely guy. Legend already in my world.
Yeah, you know, he got a shout out a few episodes back, which he was quite pleased with. Yeah. So yeah, he's
and he gets another one here. What a guy. Good. And the fact that you both wrote this together, Kindred especially, is just wonderful. It's such a brilliant film. Let's come back to Kindred, because obviously we're talking your career and how we get to making something like Kindred. You know, it's not easy to get Kindred made, get it to be a Sky Originals, get Fiona Shaw starring in it, Jack Loudon. That's not easy. And I think a lot of our listeners will want to know how you did that. But let's tease them a little bit. Let's go back a little bit and let's talk about Red Light, because I watched Red Light and it stars Jesse Buckley and it's a brilliant, brilliant short. Now, you kind of wrote this and made this to be a calling card. Talk us through that process for you, because you've made ads, commercials for years and years and years, but yet obviously you've made shorts as well. But specifically this, you wanted to, you know, use as a calling card. Talk us through this whole process of a calling card, because I've done it in the past and it's, you know, it can have benefits and it can have a lot of negatives. So I'm obviously very interested in what your experience was like.
So I'm going to take you kind of way back into the past. Mm. And so I went to film school like 22 years ago.
Which film school was it?
It was, it's changed names about 1,000 times. When we were there, it was called, for a couple of years, it was called the International Film School Wales. And then it was called the University of Wales College Newport. And then it was called Newport Film School.
Oh, that kills it, doesn't it? It's nowhere near as cool anymore.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Then it's called Newport Film School for a bit. And then I don't know what it's called now.
Right, nice.
It's moved to Cardiff, so I don't know what it's called now.
Newport College of Film and University Techniques.
Something weird. And,
something terrible. You
know. In fact, our campus that we studied at is now the set for Sex Education on Netflix. So all those buildings in Sex Education is the old film school, and kind of had like a sports science bit and stuff in Caerleon in South Wales, in this little weird little Roman village in South Wales.
How amazing. In Sex Education as well, they used a location that was kind of an old ruins, and we used that in Arthur and Merlin as well.
Right.
Totally random. Yeah. Didn't know until someone went, hang on, this was on last night. Yeah, so they obviously get around up there, those Sex Education people.
They get around a little bit. So anyway, I studied there because I think I got into filmmaking because my dad wrote adverts in like the 80s and 90s and still, until fairly recently did. So he did like some kind of well-known ones, like some Hamlet cigar ads, and he did some...
They were amazing, those ads.
Yeah.
They were amazing.
He did quite a famous one called Bunker, which is just a kind of... it's a crane shot in the end, but it starts with a lock-off of just like a golf course, and you just hear like someone attempting to hit a golf ball out of a sand bunker, and it's like... And then sand spills out of the top. And then you just see, like, you hear the sound effect of someone lighting a cigar, and you see a little puff of smoke. And then you see the guy with the golf ball in his hand throw it out onto the fairway. So that was one of his.
These were very famous adverts for those that don't know, in the 90s. And it starred the actor who played Rabsie Nesbitt, whose name is...
Yeah, he didn't do that one, to be fair, but yeah.
He didn't do that one, right. Was it the new guy? Right.
Okay. Yeah.
But God, those adverts were so famous.
He did a famous one with for Wrigley's Chewing Gum with, like, a couple on a bus. And they, like,
couple on the bus.
The
I was
going to
say the couple on the bus, and they put it together. Yeah.
And the guy gets off, and he's feeling all sorry for himself. Yeah. He gets off the bus, he's feeling sorry for himself, and then, like... The hand comes in and, like, the two bits of chewing gum meet, you know.
They touch. Chewing gum touches. They're really famous ads. Wow, your dad wrote those.
So, he was, like, he was kind of an ad dude back in the day.
And that must have inspired you massively.
Yeah, I was about 8 or 9 and we were at Pinewood, and it was just, like, opposite the 007 stage, you know, and you kind of saw that and was like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. And then just around the corner, they'd built Gotham City on the back lot. And I don't know if it was illegal, whether we were supposed to go in there, but we just wandered around Gotham City, and it must have been for It might have been Batman Returns rather than the original Tim Burton's Batman.
Yeah.
But it was one of the Tim Burton Batman films. And I remember just walking around Gotham City and just kind of like having my mind blown, you know? That is
cool.
Yeah. So yeah, I'd have been at about eight or nine. So I've been into it since then. And then like, but my dad doesn't know anyone in the kind of the film industry, like commercials and stuff. We knew a few directors, kind of. He was friends with a guy called Paul Whelan growing up, who's made a couple of films and like, but no one really. I later got to meet Alan Parker through my dad because I was doing a documentary about Volkswagen ads, and they'd worked together in my dad's kind of the early part of his career, and that was kind of a bit of a dream come true for me because Alan Parker was like a bit of a kind of legend to me. He's like a bit of a big inspiration.
Was it films like that that made you want to get into filmmaking? Was it Angel Heart? Was it those kind of Alan Parker movies that inspired you?
Yeah, I think I think like most kind of people in the industry, you've kind of got to have a bit of a mix of stuff. I think these days, you know, people tend to kind of fall into one kind of culty camp where they're into like one thing, like kind of. You're really into Marvel movies and that's your thing. Or, you know, you're really into, I don't know, sci-fi films and that's your thing. Whereas, like, I think more so back in the day, and I think now, if you know, you can kind of get your head around it. You've got to be into a little bit of everything, really, you know. So I watched a lot of, you know, obviously, like, I don't know, fairly mainstream films. And then also, like, a lot of kind of, I don't know, French films and Scandinavian films and kind of whatever you could pick up. You know, I think... Again, back in the day, you know, going to Blockbuster Video and just seeing what was in, let alone what was on the shelf, you had to try and
find what they had. Often they were sold out, weren't they? That was the thing. And then you'd have to argue with your sister over what film it was.
Although I was forever scouting the returns desk, seeing what had just come back, you know, hoping that something decent hadn't been rewound yet.
You could nab, kind of like before it went. So how did you move from there? Sort of like, obviously, it was a young age. But how did, you know, because when we're that young, it's really hard to see it as a career. You kind of, you know, it's just something someone else does. You know, how do you even step into that world? What did you do to go, I want to do this as a job? What made you go to film school? Was it like, I just want to do it?
So, yeah, I think my parents were always supportive. And I think that I never did like A-levels even. I went to, after school, I didn't do sixth form. I just went to college and did a BTEC in media. Mm. Because I was just kind of knew that I wanted to get into that industry, you know. And then after I finished that, I went to film school and then come out of film school at 22 or whatever I was. And I was like, right, I'm a director now. And then you kind of like...
Give me a job, someone.
Yeah, you walk around Soho kind of expecting to kind of like...
Someone to give you a suitcase
full of money. And then you think, oh, no, wait, this is a fucking disaster. That's not going to happen.
No, not so, unless it's the seedy nightclubs, and that's a different suitcase of money.
Yeah, it's a different kind of suitcase. Yeah. So I got a runner's job. And again, I got quite lucky in one way, is that I got a runner's job at a big commercials company called RSA, which is Ridley Scott's
huge company, yeah.
So that was a really good kind of learning experience, although I probably am still filled with quite a lot of trauma from it. Because, you know, it's hard. And I think these days people probably care about employees' mental health and general, like, kind of the kind of jobs you're made to do in those kind of subservient positions. But back in kind of the... I'd been running a bit since like the late 90s, and but that bit, I guess from about 2002 or so, it was pretty brutal. You know, you'd be literally sweeping up rat shit on abandoned warehouses for music videos, and then you'd be painting graffiti off walls, and then you'd be kind of, I don't know what, like pretty grim stuff.
No,
and
it doesn't feel like a filmmaker, you feel like a cleaner. Yeah.
No, certainly not. And also, you're not often being treated very nicely by people, you know. Back then, I think there was a lot more kind of ego going around, and a lot of kind of the directors you'd come up with, you know, were not particularly pleasant a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Having said that, in my last year at film school, I wrote a little kind of essay about a music video director called Chris Cunningham, who had done some Square Pusher videos and like Aphex Twin videos and stuff, and Madonna and Bjork and stuff. And then... you know, 6 months later, I'm kind of on set with him, you know, and having a chat to him, and he's a you like Led Zeppelin, and I like Led Zeppelin, and you kind of have a conversation about your favourite Led Zeppelin album and all that kind of stuff. And that's pretty wild, you know, to go from kind of writing about this guy and then kind of suddenly being on set with him. And like, I did one of my kind of first credits on IMDb is I was a runner on a video with him for Rubber Johnny.
Yeah, Rubber
which
Johnny.
Which is an Aphex Twin thing, which was a pretty mad experience of him being completely naked with a giant prosthetic penis and kind of elephant man makeup being pushed up and down a council estate in Camden doing a night shoot. And then in the basement at the office, like, you know, it was a pretty weird and wild experience.
Weird,
a fun
wild
one, you know.
Yeah. I think you're talking about that sort of experience of someone you'd written about and then, you know, getting to work with them. It's similar type of thing with me. I was at Drama Studio in Ealing, hence why I lived there. And I remember every sort of day we'd look over across the Ealing Studios and think, why don't we collaborate? Why can't we work there? And we'd always go to the pub next door every night and type thing. And suddenly I get a job doing I Want Candy and I'm filming at Ealing Studios opposite the drama school. And we filmed in that pub. So there I am, and like reliving my, acting school dream of actually this is a, oh my gosh, this is a thing. And that moment of magic of wow, really?
It's yeah, but I think you really have to enjoy those moments because you know, I'm really bad at always, and my wife and my therapist will probably like completely complain about this with me, but I am always looking for something in the future, you know, and not always being happy with where I am. And I think to succeed in the industry you do need a little bit of that drive to kind of like get you through the kind of the mud to the mire to the next thing.
I agree.
But you do have to kind of like smell the roses once in a while and think, oh man, this is actually pretty cool. Yeah. You know,
you need
like,
a lot of drive and only occasionally can you look it round. It's really hard to look around sometimes and go, oh, I'm doing all right. Or, oh, I've got a film on Sky. Or, oh, because you're just in it. You're just dealing with the press or you're dealing with the, interviews. Or you're just suddenly going, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh my, what's my next film? How do I survive this? And interestingly, you mentioned about your wife being a therapist. My wife is actually a therapist. So I get full on, you know.
That's the thing. Don't get me wrong. I have a therapist, but my wife is also a therapist.
Oh, your
so
wife
I have,
is
like,
as well.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, for the NHS.
Nice.
So I get double that. I get double.
Get
the help,
double. Me too. You know what I mean? It's amazing. I actually think it's really important. Filmmakers should, and we've talked about this earlier with my wife's a psychodynamic psychotherapist. Someone got in contact with me that she was working with who said, "Why don't we have counselors on set? Because this would be a really good thing for filmmakers to have on set." And I saw, but we haven't got time. We haven't got time. We're directors, we're producers, we haven't got time. And then I thought, actually, that would be a really good thing. It'd be a really good thing, especially for actors if they're going through a traumatic scene, you know, and they're, you know, like in your film, The Kindred, you know, and they're having the baby and what, all this sort of stuff that's going on. Wouldn't that be really interesting for that actor or actress to have a therapist on set to talk about
and
it with?
I think that, you know, it worked on the... I never really understood it when I was a kid. I used to watch Star Trek The Next Generation.
Of course you did.
And they had a counsellor, you know, on the ship. And I was just like, what do you mean she works for the council? That doesn't make any sense. Who's that lady? And the funny thing is my wife actually looks a bit like her, whoever the actress was that played Diana Troy in The Next Generation, and she's a counsellor.
Is that one of the reasons you married her?
It must have been. There's some weird subconscious shit
going on. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it must be. It must be. This is the first time I've met another filmmaker whose missus is a therapist.
Is a therapist.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So, I'm going to go off on a bit of a tangent here.
Please.
But one of the thematic things about Kindred is that after my second child was born, Cara, my daughter, she was born while I just shot Red Light and I was just in the middle of cutting it, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to how Red Light came about in a minute, but basically I'd shot this short film and I didn't really want to edit it myself. And I was trying to find an editor who I kind of knew, and there's a couple of people I knew in the industry, but no one had availability and stuff. And I was like, I should do it myself. And my daughter was born in the November, and I finished the film in the end in like the January or something. And it just brought up loads of stuff for me, you know, mentally becoming a dad for the second time, much more almost than it did the first time. And that's when I first started going to therapy. And that was all going on while I was writing Kindred. And Jason, my co-writer, had premature twins who were born like super, super early, like 20 something weeks, 27 weeks or something, like super early. Mm. And they were in hospital for about a month in kind of, you know, in the
intensive
in the
care,
kind of incubator things. Mm. Yeah. So, he had loads of spare time. It sounds really, really harsh. Really? But he had loads of spare time on his hands. And that was the period we got the first draft done from our kind of outline.
Wow.
We always write up notes, like my board behind, you know, we'll kind of write up scenes and get about 40 scenes or so in a kind of three-act structure in an outline document. And then that document can be anything from 7 pages to kind of 40 pages. And then it's the really laborious bit, which is translating that outline document into an actual script.
Mm.
And we got that done because his kids were in hospital, basically.
That's amazing.
So that's kind of a lot of the themes in the film about, like, you know, the main character, Charlotte, not feeling very confident as a parent, and also Fiona Shaw as Margaret, the mother-in-law, being having a lot of regret about her behavior as a parent and the guilt she feels and this and that. That's kind of directly related to how I was feeling, particularly at the time. And one of the funny things about the film coming out is that, you know, you don't write a little kind of leaflet that goes out with the film when people see it. You know, people don't see the film with the caveats and the thinking behind it. It's watched in a vacuum. And it's a slightly odd thing, because I think in a funny way, if we had had an opportunity, or, you know, if there was like a bit more of a kind of like read these notes before you watch the film, I think it would be a slightly different reading for a lot of people. You know, I think the fact it's on Sky is amazing, but it does mean that when it's given a critical response, people do think of it, oh, it's just like a mainstream kind of like thriller. You know, it's just one of those things. And particularly in the UK, bizarrely, more than the States, I've really noticed that kind of the a lot of the critical response has been predominantly from white, male, heterosexual guys, and no one has mentioned the idea of parental anxiety, and no one has mentioned the idea that, you know, there's a lot of thematic stuff going on in relation to kind of children and the fact that kind of there is a baby on the way, and everyone involved in that baby's life is kind of freaking out about it in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
Whereas in America, we had a much bigger spectrum of the kind of people that would review the film, and a bigger spectrum of the kind of like kind of demographic. You know, a lot more women, a lot more people of color, a lot more kind of non-heterosexual people would review the film, and a lot of those kind of people that aren't kind of heteronormal took a lot of different things from the film, and if anything, kind of enjoyed it more. It seemed, in a funny kind of way. So it's just a strange thing, you know. You when you make a film, I think I've always been quite careful to work thematically and to inject a lot of my personal experience and my thought process into my films. You know, when I write a script, I will also write a big lookbook to go with it, explaining my kind of thematic thinking, as well as kind of my visual approach and all that stuff. The, you know, the themes and the meanings behind things are quite a big part of it for me, and that document is as much to do with me ironing out my own thought processes as much as it is to tell my DOP that, you know, I freaked out a bit when I had my daughter.
Totally. And I think that's really important. It's kind of like your own little mini Bible, and you don't have to show anyone else. You know, sometimes I won't show the costume department or won't show the makeup department all my first thoughts on the film when I'm pitching for the job, or we're trying to get money from so-and-so, because you might have changed it by then. You've then sit and thought through with the DOP or the producers or the screenwriter, or if it's you, all of them. And your mind has changed a little bit, and you want other people's fresh take on it, but you've still got yours in the back of your mind to reference if you need. But you don't have to show everyone. I think people get frightened that doing it, you have to show.
Yeah, but I'm a big believer in, you know, when it comes to key crew, you know, you hire them for a reason, and you don't want to dictate to them the way that they approach it. And I'm quite an emotionally honest guy, probably because I've been through therapy, but I'm quite an emotionally honest guy, and I will have a conversation with people and be like, you know, my thought processes, do you want to hear them? What do you think? You know, I won't go and see them after they've read the script and be like, this is what I want the wardrobe to look like. You know, I am meeting that person. So like Natalie Humphreys, who did the wardrobe on the film and did an absolutely incredible job. We had a chat, you know. I'd have a little, like, what did you think when you read the script? And she thinks, you know, oh, you know, I could imagine them wearing X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, yeah, I totally agree with you. But what about, you know, I had this thought about the wardrobe color palette matching the location. Mm-hmm. So, and she was really up for that. So we went to the location and took some photos of the different rooms so that then we could make a color palette. And then, so it means that the characters that live in the house, they wear the same colors as the rooms they're in most mm-hmm. of the time. Yeah. And Charlotte, who goes into the house, if she's feeling rebellious, will wear a color that clashes. Or if she's feeling under their spell a bit, she will be wearing something that also matches the house, you know? So that comes about through collaboration, not through being a dictator. You know, I think a lot of people think that being a director is going marching on set and telling everyone the way it is.
Yeah.
Whereas it isn't that at all. It's, you know, it's picking the right people to help you make your film.
Totally agree with that. I think that's great. Now, what I really liked about Kindred was your colour palette and your tone, as well as I really, really enjoyed the film. But I really mm-hmm. could see you'd planned it out. I could really mm-hmm. see that you'd thought it through, you know, with the motifs in there as well, with the crows mm-hmm. and the... Well, I think there were magpies or crows. I was unsure, actually, halfway mm-hmm. through. Uh-huh. Might have been a mix. And the horses and these dark, ominous tones that you put through the movie mm-hmm. of her mind. Is mm-hmm. she going insane? Is she not? And mm-hmm. I love that. I thought it was just brilliantly thought out as a film. Mm-hmm. And we can get lost sometimes in films. We can forget what our aim was at the beginning when we set out, from mm-hmm. when we did our first colour palette and when we did our first thought process. We got images from the internet. And I think you really stuck, because I've seen your mood board and your lookbook, mm-hmm. and I think you mm-hmm. totally stuck to what you wanted. And it comes across, mm-hmm. and that's why the film shines, because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Was that always something you wanted to... Like you say, you mentioned there about your colour palette and your tone, but also mm-hmm. the motifs. Was that something that you said, this is what I want, from a very
yeah.
early stage?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes back to kind of, I'm going to loop this back professionally. I'm going to loop this back into my previous thing I was talking
love
about.
Love this. Kind of love this. That's
professional. I think a lot of this comes from what you learn as a runner watching other directors, particularly on commercial set.
Mm.
Because when you're a commercial set, you are there because, let's think of a good example. You are there because BP have paid for you to be there mm-hmm. and to direct this commercial for them. Yeah. I never did it. I never directed an ad kind of that big. But right. I remember working for this guy who was a director at RSA, and he was doing this BP commercial. And you are basically there, you're working for the client and you're working for the ad agency. And you can kick up a stink and be like, that isn't the way the shot should be. But at the end of the day, they're paying for it all. It's mm-hmm. their baby.
Yep.
And they give you a piece of paper with a storyboard on it. And they're like, there you go.
Yep.
Shoot that.
Shoot that.
And you have to work out the ego involved in that. And you're like, I, as an artist, think that this is not the best approach. Or you're the kind of guy who's just like, fine, give me the piece of paper. I'll do that for you.
Yep.
And you know, and you watch these different ways different people react in that situation. And the thing that always came to me was planning. You know, the ads and music videos and everything that came out the best were the things that they had worked out beforehand, and all those creative issues about how much the camera's going to move or what kind of trousers they're going to wear or whatever had been, someone had worked that out before you get to set. So you're not stood around for 2 hours while people have a hissy fit at each yeah. other about this stuff, you know?
Yeah, because people need to be prove that their paycheck is worth something by saying, I think yeah. these trousers should be chino brown rather than chino yeah. green.
Whereas it doesn't really make a difference most of the time.
Yeah, exactly.
So having watched all that, I think I'm going to kind of like refer back to myself in an egotistical way about my career development. So basically, having watched all that, I then was then like, I'm going to be a director now after being a runner for a couple of years, and then started working in music videos, like super low budget. And some friends of mine got signed their band called Larrick and Love. And I did a bunch of videos for them on like Super 8 for like £200. And then I got like a 15 grand budget, which is probably the most expensive video I ever did, actually.
Nice. Yeah.
And then I also did some videos for a guy called Jamie T before he got signed, or just when he was getting signed. And then a couple other people. And I never broke through. I was always like kind of waiting for the phone to ring for like the, a big production company to be like, oh, come and do a, you know, come a music video for Coldplay or whatever. But it never happened, you know. So you just got to keep hustling. So I started doing kind of like corporate-y commercials and bits and pieces and kind of whatever I can get. And I kind of work my way up in that world in a funny way. And I do a bunch of stuff for like Topshop, like online films for Topshop. And I do like some stuff for Lloyds Bank, and I do some stuff for whatever I can get. Mm-hmm. And in my head, I'm still a filmmaker, but I also know that like, I'm not really a filmmaker. I'm just doing kind of like commercial crap just to kind of pay the bills. And then I got to the point after about less than 10 years, probably about to say 10 years, eight or 10 years of doing this. I'm just like, right, I need to sort out my shit and get a film off the ground somehow. But I don't know anyone in the industry. But I know what I'm doing. I've watched these people on set and I know how to do this properly. And I know I'm really good, but no one can see the value of me. And how am I going to make this work? And, you know, no one's going to walk up to me in the street with a suitcase full of money and be like, there's your 5 million quid. You know? So how do you do that? And I haven't got any money. So I started doing short films. And I did a short film called Ribbon about like a young couple that... in order to prove that they love each other and receive her inheritance, they have to live with their hands tied together for like a week.
Nice.
And that was like a little idea, and that got into Rain Dance, and you know, did okay for itself for like 200 quid or whatever.
Sure.
And then I did one called Wake, which was like a little kind of horror-y thing, again like 300 quid I spent on that. And then I did one called Dirt, which actually got a bit of money off Nokia because they just released the N9 mobile phone,
right?
And they were like, you could, I kind of semi won a competition to, I won like 1500 quid to make a short film on this mobile phone. And decent. The problem with that is that the mobile phone was really shit and it basically didn't look good at all. And but they're all learning experiences,
of course.
And,
yeah,
I think in one way, the best thing I learned in that process was how kind of not to do it, because I go into the first one thinking, I know, I'm a director, I know what I'm doing. Yeah. And then you pretty soon work out, you're like, oh, right, no, I'm just making like slightly generic decisions in a slightly generic way and kind of making work that isn't particularly special because it doesn't mean anything to me because I think it's the way it should be done. So I had a bit of a crisis kind of confidence about like, how am I supposed to do this really?
Mm.
And my best way to react to that was like, right, what do I want to do and what can I do affordably that I find interesting? And I basically turned to documentaries. And a friend of mine, it was about this time I met the closest thing to a mentor I've ever had in the industry, who was a guy called Simon Aboud.
Simon Aboud.
Made a couple of films.
Including a film called Comes a Bright Day.
Yeah, Comes a Bright Day. Yeah. And I did the EPKs on Comes a Bright Day.
Nice, okay.
And that's how I met him, because I was doing this kind of documentary behind the scenes. I've done so many behind the scenes films on like commercials in my life. Every time it slightly destroyed part of my soul, but you know, you do it for the money. And I got this EPK gig and I didn't want to do it. And my wife was like, you should do it, 'cause you might meet someone in the film industry. And lo and behold, I met Simon Aboud, who directed and wrote that film.
There you go. Therapy and, right there.
Yeah. And he kind of took me under his wing and like, we've shot all kinds of stuff together. You know, we've been to America shooting stuff for pharmaceutical companies. We've been I've shot a couple of Paul McCartney gigs as a DOP for him. And so I DOP'd a bunch of stuff for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always been really good at like reading my scripts and giving me feedback. And he used to work at an ad agency with a guy called David Gwither, AKA Death Spray Custom, who was a painter, an artist. And so, David is into motorcycles and he was, did a thing called Flat Track. He still does a thing called Flat Track motorcycle racing. So I went with him one weekend to like King's Lynn and filmed him doing Flat Track. And I made a little short film about it. And I got a Vimeo staff pick.
Amazing.
And I was like, okay, that was good. I enjoyed that. And I think it's good. And I think that piece of work reflects the way I want to make things and the way that I see the world. So then I went and made a kind of profile film about David called Things That Can Kill You. And that won a Vimeo staff pick. And I was like, right, okay,
I'm onto something.
Now I can, I kind of feel like I'm suddenly getting my voice. Like before with the kind of really cheap short films, I really felt like I was kind of imitating people. And now all of a sudden I feel like I'm kind of speaking in my own voice, you know?
Yeah.
And then I did one, my dad had written a book in the 80s and 90s. called Remember Those Great Volkswagen Ads, which is about VW ads in like the 70s in New York, 60s and 70s in New York.
Yeah.
And the guy he had written the book with had died not long ago, a guy called David Abbott. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting thing, that campaign. And they had some archive that had been filmed with the people back in the day who'd written the ads. So I made a kind of 12-minute, maybe it's more than that, 15-minute short film about that ad campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Then that got a Vimeo staff pick. And I'm like, right, okay, I've got three staff picks. I've done these documentaries. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling kind of like lean and muscular and like I'm ready to get my teeth into something.
Yep.
I'm going to write a short film and I'm going to make the damn thing. So I write a short film called Red Light. Actually, what had happened was I was walking around Soho, as you do.
As you do.
And that
looking
comic
for
shop.
That box of 5 million.
Yeah, the box of money. Yeah. And at the bottom of Berwick Street, you know, they've opened that comic shop on the corner. The name of which I can't remember. Forbidden... At the bottom of Berwick Street Market.
Yeah,
before you
okay.
go through the weird sex alley.
Yes, yes.
Gosh, is it called Gosh?
It is called Gosh. I think you're right, it might be called Gosh. Yeah.
And I went in there just looking around. I read graphic novels quite a lot. I found this kind of weird self-published book of like short stories from this guy whose name escapes me, who was most famous for doing a kind of punk... girl punk kind of motorcycle gang thing in the 80s.
Okay.
And I was flicking through it and they had this little short story in it, which wasn't called Red Light, it was called something else. And that the key part of the plot, which is about this guy who goes to see a prostitute to convince her to leave with him, was from that. So I read the story and I was like, mate, that's kind of inspired me to write this thing. So I wrote the script and I emailed the guy out of the blue and I'm like, hi, I just... like you kind of inspired me to write this short. I don't know if I legally have to get an option off you, but like it would be really good if I could kind of like get your blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy was like, yeah, man, amazing. That sounds great. I was like, okay, cool. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So then I had this short film script and didn't have much money and no real way of making it. And the one thing I had learned up to this point is that cast in low budget stuff, cast means a lot, because if you've got your mate Dave from down the pub in the film, no one really wants to watch it.
No,
it's always going to be slightly cheap, you know. And if you can get someone decent or someone famous in your film, people are more likely to watch it, you know.
And festivals are more likely to pick it up. It's just fact, in case they turn up. Yeah, it's fact.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I was a bit stuck and I had this short film Red Light ready to go and I didn't really know what to do with myself. And then we were having a baby, my wife and I were having our first kid. And this is actually quite a good story. We're having our first kid. And we went to a... I just shot a Paul McCartney thing that day as a DP for Simon Abood.
Yeah.
And the following day, we go to this... In Islington, because it's a weird borough with like some really super rich people and also some really super poor people.
Yep.
The council put on like a free antenatal baby class, right?
Okay.
So you can pay for the NCT one, which we did as well, but you can also go to this freebie one. And we're like, oh, you know, whatever, we'll go along.
It's free.
So I go along to this freebie antenatal class, and it is in this weird kind of like social room in a council estate on Caledonian Road. And it is full of like pregnant teenagers smoking fags and like really strange, slightly shady people.
Oh,
and there's this kind of other kind of like posh couple there who scarper immediately when they see the kind of the vibe. But there's this other couple who look a bit like my wife and I, who are kind of getting involved and chatting away.
Yep.
And it gets near lunchtime and I start chatting to them. And I'm like, well, you know, what are you guys doing for lunch? And they're like, oh, I don't know. And I'm like, oh, that's my friend recommended. I text my buddy Gemma, who lived around the corner. And I was like, where's good to eat? She's like, you're in the wrong place. But there's a pizza place that's kind of vaguely edible. So I was like, oh, my friend recommended this pizza place. We'll go. So we go to the pizza place and we get chatting to this couple. And I'm like, oh, so what do you guys do? And he goes, I'm a film producer. And I'm like,
of all the places in all the world.
Yeah. And I'm like, really? He's like, yeah. I'm like, that's funny. He's like, what do you do? I'm like, I'm a director. He's like, no way. I'm like, yeah. And I bet he thought, oh, fucking hell, here we go.
Okay, another one. Really? Are you though?
Yeah.
You wish you'd said it first. Yeah.
You can't even go to prenatal baby class without some guy saying he's a director. But I just, because I think because I'd just done this Paul McCartney thing, I sounded kind of more impressive than I was, you know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, it wasn't particularly any great shakes what I'd done on this gig. Anyway, so we got chatting and we were having our kids at the same time. And lo and behold, that producer, Dominic Norris, produced Red Light and Kindred. And I met him at a prenatal baby class.
That's amazing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, because I didn't know anyone in the industry. Do you know what I mean? I haven't got contacts. I haven't got a cousin who works at Universal. Sure. I haven't got a mate who's an agent or any of that stuff.
No.
I still don't have an agent in the UK.
No, like, no.
So,
it's fascinating that.
It's just luck, pure, you know, pure luck.
Isn't it funny how sometimes just those little conversations, just those little... little things where you never expect it can actually open the door for you.
But and, as everyone says, you make your own luck by being friendly and approachable and asking people questions. Yeah. And if I'd met him and been an asshole, we would never have made a film together.
No, but, of course not. I mean, he produced Modern Life is Rubbish.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
Daniel Jerome Gill came on the podcast to talk about, which I love that film. Yeah. It's so cool. And The Obscure Life of the Grand Duke of Corsica, which is Matt Hookings, is one of his latest films, which should be out very soon.
Yeah, soon. Niche, I guess.
Tim Spall starring in that.
But, anyway, so I met Dom, and then he was just making Modern Life is Rubbish, and he's like, let's do a short film together then. I was like, oh, I've got this red light. He was really into it, but then I had to wait for him to finish that, and it took ages, and I had a baby, and it was a bit like, oh, God, is this ever going to happen?
Yeah,
but we finished. What happened was we were trying to cast Red Light, and I just watched, there was a TV show on, Remember Me, I think it was called, and it had Jodie Comer in it.
Yeah, Remember Me. Yeah, it was very good.
And she was like a school coach. She was young at the time.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, man, she'd be really good. And then it took so long. By the time we were kind of actually physically casting for the film, she was kind of like off doing something much more impressive and big and stuff. And you're like, oh, God. And casting's such an arduous process.
It really is.
But through Dom, I met a lady called Alice Searby, who's still my kind of casting director on everything I do at the moment. And she helped us out, basically. And what had happened was we got Martin McCann and we couldn't get a girl who was right for us for Red Light for ages. And we had kind of the shoot date kind of organised and circled in the diary, and it was getting kind of like 3 months away. You're like, ah, I've got 3 months. And then all of a sudden it's 2 months where you're like, oh, no way, hang on a minute. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden you've got like 6 weeks and you're like, oh, God, we've got to find someone who's good enough to do the part. And then through Jack Loudon, who Dom knew, because Dom had cast Jack Loudon in Modern Life is Rubbish, and he'd signed on to do it, and then he got offered the Morrissey gig in England is Mine, and had to pull out, and he basically owed Dom one a little bit. So we sent him the script, and was like, you know everyone, like, who would be good for this that you know? And he's like, oh, Jesse Buckley. And I'm like, Jesse Buckley, to be fair, Beast hadn't been out yet. So she kind of, her star hadn't quite, hadn't risen to where it is now. Certainly.
No, but she'd still done some massive telly. Yeah.
Everyone knew who she was.
Yeah.
And everyone knew she was going to be big.
Yeah.
And she seemed unachievable to me. And I was like, Jesse Buckley's not going to do this. Kidding. Yeah. He's like, well, I'll send it to her, see what she says. Then lo and behold, Jesse Buckley's like, yeah, what, do you want to meet for a coffee? I'm like, yes. So, you know, you meet Jesse Buckley for a coffee and, you know, you walk into those meetings and you're thinking, oh, Jesus, what's going to happen with this conversation?
Yeah.
This could go any direction.
I take it you were prepared. You'd gone in and you'd thought about what you were going to say. Like, it was,
as ever, you know.
Crosses on your hand.
I'd written the script. I'd written the lookbook.
Yeah.
You know, I'd got all that stuff organised. The visual reference was ready. And so you go to the meeting.
Yeah.
And 9 times out of 10, if people have read the script and looked at the lookbook, they know what you're about. Mm-hmm. And they just want to find out if you're an idiot or not.
That's
or an asshole or not.
Yeah.
You know, it comes down to a kind of personality thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jessie and I got on kind of like a house of fire. She's great, man. She's so cool and really talented. And we were so lucky to get her. And then, but Martin McCann as well. I mean, he's amazing. And he should be a much bigger deal than he is. And he's only, for me, he's only one role away from really kind of like becoming a kind of stand-up guy. He'd done The Survivalist at that point. That's what I'd seen him in. Mm-hmm. And it kind of blown me away. But he's like super good and super intense and perfect for that film.
Yeah.
So I got really lucky, basically, and got those two. They're funny enough, everyone in the film is Irish.
Yeah, so therefore
even,
you were like...
Well, even Ben Peel, who's like kind of the bad guy, he's Irish as well.
So how was that experience shooting that, you know, now looking back, now you can with different glasses on. Mm. How was that experience for you? Obviously, it was a big deal at the time because we talked about at the beginning, potentially this is a calling card for you.
Yeah.
You've got big names in it now. This will get festival recognition.
Yeah.
Was there a pressure on you to do, you know, did you feel that pressure or were you just enjoying it?
I guess you kind of feel the pressure to a certain extent, but at the same time, I'd feel like if I've done my homework, I've got enough, you know, as a creative, you know, you basically have a dual kind of schizophrenic ego, where on one hand you think, yeah, I'm the greatest thing that ever lived. And at the same time, you're like, oh my God, I'm going to get found out. Yes. You know what I mean? I'm going to get found out one of these days. And so like, you've just got to try and get as close to the kind of more egotistical side of that as you can, yeah, when you're going into those situations, and not be an asshole about it, but just be confident. And like, if you're prepared and someone asks you a question, you know, if someone says, you know, where do you want the camera to go? You're like, over there. Like, because I've already thought this out. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And but mm-hmm, also with those guys, it was more about performance, you know, and talking to them. It's a two-house. So for those who haven't seen it, you should check it out on my my website on markantonio.tv. It's on there. It's
It'll on, be on the show well. Notes. Link will be in the show notes.
And it's basically two-hander about this guy who goes to see a prostitute and tries to convince her to leave her life of kind of, you know, sexcapades behind, mm-hmm, and to run off with him because he's deeply in love with her. And it's got a bit of a kind of, like, you know, a bit of a twist at the end. And, you know, a lot of that was just in the script, I think. And the actors were into it. And we, I got the guy who used to, when I was a DP, he was my focus puller. And when I was a director, he used to kind of be my DP. I could, Drew Lawrence. He shot it for me.
Nice.
So it was kind of like, I was very involved in the kind of the camera in that. That felt quite important to me at the time. We got a deal with Panavision through a commercials link to get some decent lenses, some anamorphics.
Mm-hmm.
We got a camera package off them. We got the only lights we used in the whole short film were two soft boxes from IKEA and a bare red light bulb in the windowsill.
No way.
So the whole thing is shot with practicals.
Nice.
And yeah, we just kind of like made it as cheap as we could. I'd just done a couple of jobs for Honda motorcycles, despite the fact I've never sat on a motorbike in my life. I DP'd a couple of gigs for them.
Nice.
That were kind of decent money jobs, and I immediately spent all the money on that short film. So that short film probably cost me $5,000 or something, which in the grand scheme of things was a worthwhile investment.
Totally worthwhile investment.
But it's not small change when you've got a lot of money.
It's really
not. And equally, you know, I think in hindsight, it makes a lot of sense. But there were a few moments at the time where you're just like, oh, God, is this a good idea or
not? It's frightening putting your own money into stuff. How did you find working with the actors then? Because like I say, the big actors, it sounds like you just got on with it. But how do you direct them?
This loops back. Actually, this might be an interesting thing, is that I was always really paranoid about directing actors because I had never really had much experience with it, you know?
Mm, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
I grew up as a teenager with a guy called Jake Curran, who's an actor who is in Bits and Pieces. He's like a kind of redheaded, kind of like, he's never the leading man, but he's been in
some of your shorts though, right?
Yeah. So I've known him for a long time. Yeah. So I kind of quiz him about it and what he wants a director to do and kind of how that works. But I was still paranoid. I ended up actually doing like a short course at the NFTS, like a kind of a week long, I guess it was a week long. Course on directing actors, which actually ended up being, if anything, a kind of confidence booster, because I'm like, oh right, there isn't a secret key to unlock this box. It is just all about approach and, you know, empathy, I think, is the biggest part of it for me. And so doing the course, you're supposed to, at some point in that course, I remember you're supposed to like take this script and like break it down and then like get these actors to kind of like do it two or three different ways and to kind of work out which way you prefer. And I didn't do that at all. I took the script and broke it down and then just sat the actors down. It was like, look, I'm not interested in directing you guys. I want to talk to you about what you expect a director to do and what a good director does with you guys. And, you know,
which is great for you. They must have been like, seriously?
yeah. But they were like, oh, you know what? Actually, you know, the thing that drives me mad is people, you know, telling me the way I should pronounce my lines or whatever it is. You know, you kind of like get into that with them.
Yes.
And then I found that part of it the most interesting, you know. And then, you know, you read books. There's like a book you can get in Waterstones about directing actors. I read that. And then there's a really good filmmaking book by Sidney Lumet. Is it called On Film?
It's called On Film. Yes, it is. I think it's which On is Film. Like, yes, it is. Yes.
Which is like the best filmmaking book I've ever read, you know. So, I think I got to that point. And then by the time I'd made Red Light, I was feeling kind of good about things. And I'm quite an open and kind of approachable guy. And I think also like I said, I'm quite emotionally honest, and kind of if I'm a bit nervous, I'll be like, look, I'm not an egotist in this thing. Like, this is what I was thinking. How do you guys feel about it? You know, and you work it through with them. You know, it's the same as hiring crew members. It's a collaboration. And if you hire actors that good, I mean, you just point a camera at them, really. You know, that's the gig.
That's it.
And yeah, I remember, like, sure, Jake saying to me years ago, like, one of the things he really likes about me as a director is that I'm not bossing him around all the time, because some people do, you know. And I think that, I think Spielberg's quite famous for that, not bossing people around. They'll be like, oh, do we got any direction? He's just like, well, no, like, I hired you to do a job. Like, just do it. Don't worry about it. You know, that's what it's all about.
Well, I think that's when, with experienced actors, they totally know that. But I think new actors, and I mean that in the, you know, people who maybe it's their first time on set or first few times on set, they need to be directed, or they want some kind of arm around their shoulder, you know, metaphorically, to say, you're doing well. Because they've come maybe from a theatre background or drama school where they haven't. You know, everything's been about the minute detail of that performance. So I think it really does. It depends who the actor is. If they're, you know, like Fiona Shaw, well, you don't necessarily need to go, brilliant, Fiona, you smashed it.
The interesting thing about Fiona is actually, because Kindred had a slight, I'd kind of progressed my technique a bit by then. I'll get to that in a minute. So with Red Light, basically, it was the big thing I was really working on was blocking and getting the theme, because there's two people in a room, you know, other than them just sit there talking to each other, how do you make that interesting? And so had this idea that we have, like, the most of the scene is lit by a kind of bare red light bulb in the windowsill, and the closer that Jessie's character gets to the window, the more she's feeling like she has to stay where she is, and the further away from it she gets, the more she feels torn that maybe she should be leaving. And then so you play with that in the blocking, so you work out where in the scene those moments are, and you give them a reason to move around the room. And so you spend a lot of time with the script, with no, just me and the two actors in the room, talking that through and working out where the blocking should be. And then if you're lucky, it works, you know. And I think it worked pretty well.
It definitely did.
But the funny thing is that short film came out. I'm super proud of it. I'm really pleased with it. But it came out around the same time that North Korea was about to launch everyone to nuclear Armageddon, and a bunch of other quite dark things were happening. And I think we didn't get the festival run I felt we kind of deserved a bit, because I think it was a bit dark. I think it was a bit much for a lot of people.
It's sometimes the timing is so important, isn't it? And you never know. You can't say, I'm not going to make this because timing might change in 6 months. You've got to get on with it.
That's kind of, you got to be true to yourself in all the decisions you make. Really. Yeah. You don't want to. That's one of the things that's happened to me in the past with casting, is that you, like, through circumstance, you go out to someone and you're like, oh God, I'm not really sure they're the right person for the job. And then you feel a bit like, oh God, are they right? It's like, you've got to go with your gut all the time. You know, if you don't think they're right, they might get you the money or whatever it is. But if you don't think they're right, then you shouldn't go to them, you know.
I love that advice. Well, let's talk about Kindred then.
This is literally where we cross the streams in a Ghostbusters sense. So we finished Red Light and Dom was like, right, okay, well, let's make a feature, you know? Yeah. What are we going to do? Yeah. So the whole time since graduating film school, I've been writing. And by that point, I had written probably about 8 scripts or 9 scripts, of which 7 were completely useless or just not very good, you know?
But that's a good thing. I think that's good.
You've got to get it out.
You've got to get it out. Get rid of the shit so that there's some good stuff and you know that it's crap. That's good. Yeah. It's a good place to be.
But I'd had 2... that I thought were actually pretty good, and I think they are actually pretty good. So I had those 2 scripts, but neither of them were right as a first-time thing. Die Young was too violent and hasn't got the kind of appeal. You couldn't cast anyone big enough in it to get the money, particularly as a first-time director. We could have done it as like a no-budget, like 100 grand feature, but Dom wasn't particularly interested in that. So I went through my folder of 20... or 30 kind of other little kind of ideas and log lines and this, that and the other. And then this one jumped out to us about a woman whose partner dies and his family take her in, and she's pregnant and they basically want her to have the baby at home with them because they're worried she's going to run off. And I had that as a log line, and I'd had it for about 10 years and didn't really know what to do with it because it sounded a bit kind of fritzily, sounded a bit dark, you know. And then I think having had a kid, suddenly that old ideas suddenly had kind of new life put into it. And I was like, oh, no, I could make this more of a kind of suspense film than a horror film, and make it more about the kind of the mental kind of difficulties of parenthood, and put all of that into it, you know?
Yeah.
And Don was into it.
Nice.
And so I started writing it, and then immediately kind of hit a brick wall and was like, oh, man, this is actually not going as easily as I thought it would. And I was kind of had a bit of a kind of ticking clock, because I knew Don wanted something. And so I gave Jason a ring, and he'd written something a few years before that I'd read, which is all set in one house with a daughter and a dad in a house.
Mm.
And I was really impressed by how he'd managed to set the whole kind of 45-page script, whatever it was, in one location. So he jumped on board and was really up for it. And we'd always been collaborating on bits and pieces. But he helped me out, and we basically, it was a true collaboration, basically. We much like my kind of my board behind me, that may have even have been in action back then, I think.
Nice.
It's kind of like, you know, you get scenes on bits of card and you stick them up and you work out which ones work and which ones don't, and then you kind of write them out to an outline. And then, like I said earlier, he had babies in the hospital and we turned the outline into a script. And I think it probably took about 7 or 8 months to get from a sentence to a script.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Not bad. Yeah.
Yeah, it was not too bad. We both had other work on, do you know what I mean?
It wasn't a full-time
endeavour.
No,
and then then it was a bit of a wait, because you try and get actors involved. And we sent it to Jack Loudon, and then he was into it, and he wanted to board as a producer. And you're like, okay, that's amazing.
Yeah. To get someone like him to come on board as producer, when, you know, Jack Loudon's, you know, the next big thing in my eyes. He's fantastic. Yeah. He's been brilliant in everything he's in. He's chameleic, if you like. He's also
really disturbingly nice.
I love that too.
Yeah, he's super cool.
It's really cool. So to have him on as producer, now you've got Dominic Norris pushing to get a film made, we're in a great place.
Yeah. And then you're like, right, okay. Casting wise, and actually something interesting happened is that when Alice Searby, the casting director, came on, we were talking to her. She's like, look, I think that there's a potential here to get someone really interesting in for the Margaret role, but I don't think there's enough in the script for them. And I was like, right, okay. She's like, do you think you can give them a little bit more? I don't know, like beef the part up slightly. And the whole time I basically had this kind of monologue in my head for her to do.
Yeah,
and I was like, yeah, man, I know exactly what to do, because I was kind of toying with doing it anyway. And that night I basically sat down with a kind of stiff drink and kind of wrote, kind of poured my heart out. And it's a lot of it's my own personal experience twisted into kind of Margaret's words, don't get me wrong. But to this day, I wrote this monologue for her that's a kind of 3.5 minute kind of uninterrupted shot in the film.
It's full on that
I can't really watch with anyone else in the room, because it makes me feel a bit queasy. Basically, it's a bit too close to the bone. So I wrote that into it, and she was like, perfect. What do you think about Fiona Shaw? And I'm like come on, like,
well, yes,
you know, like, really, like, do you think she'd do it? She's like, well, all you can do is ask, you know. That's the thing with these things. All you can do is ask. So we sent it to Fiona's people, I guess, and they're like, oh, do you want to meet for a coffee? I'm like, well, yeah.
So and at this point, sorry to say, it's a great and loving where you're going, but at this point, did you have any money? Did you have anything in place?
No, we got no, I mean, at least I didn't. I mean, I don't know what goes on behind the scenes. We may have got some seed money for Dom to kind of help him pay the bills while he was making phone calls and stuff, but like,
sure. But nothing, there wasn't we've got a mill from this person, or we've got a letter of intent from, you know, Sky.
Not yet. Nothing. I mean, I guess actually by the time we went to Fiona, we probably had some money promised by someone. I am blessedly naive to the financial wranglings of this stuff, because I find that it makes me feel sick. It's too stressful. I am much more kind of a head in the sand, you know. I've got my horse blinkers on, basically, and I'm just like, look, I'll do all the creative stuff and do this.
Yeah, just tell me how much I've got and where I need to be.
All this I'll other stuff, I like to find it really hard going. And Dom's really good at that stuff, and he knows everyone.
Great. And I've really had to learn this stuff. You know, I've produced a good couple of movies now. I'm about to produce another one, and I've learned all this. I've learned about, you know, EIS. I've learned about shares in companies, and really got to grips with it. Mm. I don't want to do that. Yeah. I want to be creative, like you're talking about. Mm. But I've had to do that just to get things keep moving, because otherwise everyone else is waiting for someone else to do it. So I thought, well, equally, I'll just get on with it.
But what did happen to us is that just before we started shooting, one of our main financiers was like, oh, you know what? We're not actually going to finance films that are less than 5 million anymore. And took the promise away. And then we were kind of left adrift for a couple of days until Dom came to the rescue and got someone else involved. Okay. So it kind of, there was a moment like we'd just done the read through and Dom phoned me and was just like, you know, I know we're supposed to be shooting next week, but there's a chance.
Oh my gosh, this is a
there's
week.
A chance it's not going to happen. And he's just like, oh God, really? He's like, yeah, I'm on the case, but you know, and that has kind of, that's fairly nuts ramifications down the line.
Really,
but basically, where was I? So we went to Fiona Shaw, met for a coffee, and then she's just the nicest person, like, ever. She's the nicest person since Jessie Buckley. Do you know what
really?
I mean? Yeah, man, they're super cool.
That.
And I think if they're into the script, they, like I say, they want to make sure you're just a stand-up guy who's not going to mess them around, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I had my cup of tea with Fiona Shaw, and then she wanted to talk about the scripts a couple of weeks later. So I went and met her in her agent's office, had another chat with her there, and then she invited me around her house for tea. So I went around her house for tea.
How nice.
Like, what do you do? And it turned out she lived right around the corner from
what
where
you
I used
do?
To live. I was just like, you know, what do you turn up to Fiona Shaw's house? I took some biscuits. Because I'm like, I don't know
that.
If she drinks.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
know. She, like, what do you do? She
you
said
don't want
tea.
To take just in case, drink just in case. Yeah,
yeah.
Biscuits.
So it's just
idea.
Like, I take biscuits. So I took biscuits. They never got opened, I don't think. But she appreciated the...
The gesture. Well,
the
thank
gesture.
You for this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's very kind of you, but we'll be having something I've already prepared, dear.
Yeah. But she what she does, she's really fastidious. She makes so many notes. And she's just always asking questions. And like I say, a lot of thinking goes into the stuff I write. So like a lot of her character, Margaret, is like based on family members I've had, like my grandmother, and kind of experiences I've had talking to other people and all kinds of things. And she's got a little notebook and she's asking me questions like, oh, there's this scene here. Like, what's going on with Margaret? You know, why is she, I don't know, giving that monologue? For example, she'll talk to me about the monologue and I'll be like, oh, right, okay. Well, the idea is, I actually wrote that because I've just been going through some shit, having become a parent for the second time and like freaking me out. And like, I've started going to therapy and it's all a bit nuts.
Yeah.
And she fucking laps it up. She loves it. Cause she's like, okay, amazing. I can see where you're coming from. And now that for her, that opens up the way she approaches the character and she understands, you know, it makes life more interesting for her in a funny kind of way. She knows that I'm just not bullshitting her or making it up, you know, like.
Which is very important, I think, with actors. Mm. You can't make it. Sometimes you have to make it up on the spot. Mm. You go, you need to make a decision, but you have to know what you're talking about. They have to trust you.
There has to be meat on the bones, because if there's no meat on the bones, you get found out too quickly.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, far too quickly. Me, Giles, obviously, are jumping in here to tell you, officially, this is a two-parter. Myself and Joe had such a great chat, I didn't want to cut it down. Tobias is away at the moment, and I only recorded this today. It's going out for you in a few hours. So, because of that, I haven't got time to fully dive in and cut stuff out. And actually, listening through, I didn't want to. There was so much gold in there for you to take away and learn from. I felt you needed to talk. So this is a two-parter, so join us on Friday when myself and Joe go deeper into the casting process, what it's like directing actors, how when a film is released it can be traumatic, and how it felt to get picked up and released on Sky Movies. We also talk about getting a manager and an agent in the UK, and he gives you amazing, wonderful filmmakers out there some brilliant advice. So come join us again on Friday for part two of my chat with Joe, Mark, Antonio. Until then, go watch Kindred on Sky and then do something this week to get your film made. Do it. Be inspired now and go get your film made. Do something, the tiniest little thing, even if it's finishing that page of dialogue, even if it's reaching out to a producer, even if it's reaching out to an actor or doing it yourself. Do it this week. Be inspired. Get it done. And I will see you on Friday.